The World's Yearling Sale. Make plans for the Keeneland September Yearling Sale, September 13th through the 24th. Visit theworldsyearlingsale.com to learn more.
Good morning. It is 9:37, Tuesday, August 17th. This is the 100th episode of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And for anybody who happened to see me on the Capital OTB show on Sunday, it's true. I only brought one collared shirt for this trip.
Hi, I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. And rather than trying to be snarky or witty or something, I thought I'd try something different, John. I'm dead serious about this. I wanted to kind of be sentimental and poignant. We all remember the first time we ever went to a baseball game or something like that. First time I ever, back in Saratoga, the first time I ever went there was 1972. I was a little boy, and I was in a car accident and spent the entire summer in the hospital. And my parents brought me when I got out of the hospital to celebrate my getting out. And the first day I got here, what did I see but the 1972 Sanford Stakes? Now, come on, who won that race?
Who won the Sanford Stakes?
1972. Because this is not that hard.
Man of War. Oh,
see, now, you always got to go for the lowest common denominator. I'm trying to be sweet and sentimental here, and you come up with a wise-ass answer like that. This is not, I know it's before your time, this is not that hard.
Secretariat.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. So my very first trip ever to Saratoga, the very first day, I saw a Secretariat one.
Wow. That's wonderful. Yes. That's wonderful. And all it took was a car crash for you to do that. All right. Well, I'm going to bring us back to reality. Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And I can't believe that we've got 100 shows and that this is the first time I'm going to do this. Break the fourth wall.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland, home of the World's Yearling Sale. Make plans to attend the Keeneland September Yearling Sale beginning Monday, September 13th. The catalog is now available online with 4,034 offerings at catalog.keeneland.com. We're less than a month away from the Keeneland September Sale. I know John will be there. And all the big wigs, not just John, the biggest of the wigs, will be at Keeneland September. We're looking forward to it. All right, so it was a fun weekend of racing here at Saratoga, just on a personal level. It was incredibly gratifying and rewarding to be back at Saratoga after missing it last year. It really felt like everything was back to normal, and everything downtown was lively and hopping, and it was just great to watch the horses walk by and see everybody having a good time, see the bros playing beer pong, and you see the blue hairs drinking whatever the old ladies drink. But no, it was great to be back. I love it. Just such a buzz here at Saratoga, and it's so much fun. The second you walk in, it's like you never left. But on the racetrack, I think obviously the headliner was Got Stormy coming back to win her second four-star Dave Stakes, and that was, you know, that's a super accomplishment. I think there are only three horses that have ever won that race twice. She's the first filly to do it. She got a 104 buyer. Congrats to a friend of the show, Mark Cassie, who was on last week, had him on a week too early, as John said. But she's one of those interesting horses where, you know, every year I think, well, Got Stormy's lost a step. And then every year in the four-star Dave, she comes back and proves me wrong. And she did it last year, even when she ran second. She was a very good second. And then obviously she won it 2 years ago. She's a very, very admirable mare. And it was good that the new owners, or at least the new part owners, Spendthrift, brought her back to the races this year. Because even though I could never have had her at 12-1, she killed all of my bets. It was one of those things where, as a fan, you were happy to see it because you like to see horses stepping out of the box, fillies taking on the boys, and horses that are, you know, getting up there in age, 6-7 years old, still be able to compete at that top level. So it was very cool and very, a very good story on a beautiful Saturday of racing at Saratoga. And the other big horse was High Oak in the Saratoga Special. You know, Gormley's son, who for Lee Einsiedler and the crew, and Bill Mott, very, very impressive. We were saying earlier in the year that, earlier maybe a month or so ago, that there hadn't really been these breakout two-year-old male performances yet. We've got two, I think. We've got Wit and now High Oak in the Saratoga Special. And Speaker's Corner I want to talk about as well, because he was one of those horses, his reputation kind of preceded him last year. He was bet down to 3-5 in his debut, had a pretty nice win in his second out, beating Caddo River and a couple other nice horses. Hadn't been seen since then. Came back at a 7-furlong race. Mott wanted to go two turns with him. Race didn't fill, came back at 7 furlongs and just blew apart a very, very nice one other than allowance field. A really typical, strong, one other than Allowance Field at Saratoga. So it'll be interesting to see where he goes next. My guess is the Pennsylvania Derby, probably too quick of a turnaround to go to the Travers. But John, let's hear some thoughts from you about the weekend at Saratoga.
Well, I think you did a great job, just itemizing all the reasons why God Stormy was such an impressive winner. And you talk about a horse for course. She's run four times here at Saratoga, all grade one races, and has three wins in a second place. I mean, it's just unbelievable the way that this mare continues to run and run and run. And what we forget is she was 12-1 for a reason. Number one, it was a really deep field. And number two, she had run fifth three out of her last four starts. So it wasn't like she was at the top of her game anymore, at least according to, to her recent history. You had Raging Bull, who was the favorite. Maybe he was overbet. Obviously, now you can look back and say he shouldn't have, he was a false favorite. You had three fillies in a grade one, which is, again, really unusual to run against the boys, including Blowout and Daddy's a Legend. But again, I think it comes down to Got Stormy and just what a great training job Mark Cassie did for this mare. She's kind of at that stage of her life where they're going to really be careful with the races they put her in. They're going to point her, obviously, for the Breeders' Cup. Now she has a win and you're in. She's automatically in the mile race if she wants to go there. But at this stage of her game, I personally think that she's probably really like a 7-furlong horse, more so than a miler or a turf sprinter. So she's kind of in that in-between stage. But hat off to her, because Mark Cassie and his crew did a phenomenal job getting her ready for this particular race. Again, she loves the course, and she won, emphatically. It wasn't like she just caught him at the end and won by a nose. I mean, she dominated that race, and Tyler Gaffleone just kept her clear of the speed, ran down the speed at the top of the stretch, and the rest is history. So it was great to see.
Yeah, I mean, she blew him away too, and it's you said this to me after the race, and we were texting about it, whether or not he's going to go to the mile or the sprint with her. I think the Breeders' Cup being at Del Mar and being 5 furlongs, I think that's too sharp for her. So I think she'll definitely end up in the mile. And we'll see. We'll see if she's able to carry this race forward. I think that's been the issue with her the last couple of years. She runs these great races at Saratoga and then fades a little bit, at least in the fall. But like I said, it was great to see her. She's a very popular mare, and it was a popular victory, I think, on Saturday in front of a great crowd here at Saratoga. It was perfect weather. Just missed the heat wave. Came up Saturday morning, so sorry for everybody who had to deal with that last week. But it was a lot of fun, and it's just great to be back here. We're gonna have a couple people sitting in the guest chair who can really speak to how special it is to have fans back at Saratoga and have a sense of normalcy back here. But shifting a little bit, we also had a big day at Arlington, and unfortunately, kind of the last big day at Arlington, and we have some opinions about the way people were treated on the way out the door at Arlington. But first, let's break down the actual results of the day. You had the huge upset in the Arlington Million. It's hard for me to call it the Mr. D Stakes. I still call it the Million.
We'll call it the Arlington 600,000, okay, if you want.
Yeah. Bill chooses to be negative about the purse.
But I've learned from the best, John Green.
I'm Mr. Sunshine in the middle all of a sudden. But that was a cool result. Two Emmys. Again, could have never had that horse in a million years. I wouldn't have bet that horse with Monopoly money, as my friends like to say. 36-1. But again, aggressive riding is rewarded. James Graham took that horse to the front in a race with no speed and held off Domestic Spending, who I think was kind of up against it with that pace, and I think didn't disgrace himself running second. But it was local connections. Hugh Robertson, I think the horse was a $4,500 purchase, which is absolutely incredible. And the other horse I wanted to mention from there was Santa Barbara in the Beverly D. She was incredibly impressive, to the point where I almost forgot that she was a three-year-old going against Elders. I forgot that she won the Belmont Oaks just a month or two ago, because she dominated those older fillies and mares, and she was loaded on the turn. If you want an example of a horse who was just dying to be let loose, watch Santa Barbara on the far turn of the Beverly D. And once she got in the clear at the top of the stretch, it was over for the rest of that field. Mean Mary ran okay to be second after breaking through the gate to start. But those were two really impressive performances. Santa Barbara will be interesting to see what she does going forward. John, you mentioned the other day that they might keep some horses in America to run at Kentucky Downs.
Well, again, it's a situation where the O'Briens are coming in and stealing everybody's lunch.
Yeah.
And this is Santa Barbara, just the most recent example of that. And it's interesting because, the O'Briens, everyone kind of cobbles them together, but it's Aiden the father who, is a legend in unto itself. And then Joseph and Donica, his sons, are winning races all over the place. And last week, Joseph, won the big turf race here, the $1 million turf race here. So it's a matter of, You know, just them coming and bringing their top shelf horses. I think Bill said that a couple of weeks ago about how in the past, you know, the O'Briens and other Euros were coming over with kind of the B team and faring okay.
Yeah.
But now the gloves are off. They're bringing their top shelf, you know, horses. And I think it's primarily to run in the turf races now in the late summer, early fall, and then roll into some of the bigger meets like the Kentucky Downs, Keeneland, and then stay here for the Breeders' Cup. So if you have a turf horse and you're based here in America, watch out, because there are some big boys coming to town.
And big girls, too, in Santa Barbara. Bill, what did you think about the Arlington races?
Yeah, I mean, a couple other notes. I mean, first of all, it was, you know, obviously observation about the Mr. D Stakes. And you just see this time and time again, and you scratch your head. I mean, look, two Emmys, good for him. He wins the race. But when you get to the front in 26, 52-2, and 116-3, I mean, that certainly makes
that third quarter
job.
Was 24-1.
Yeah, yeah. Come on, he had to work at some point. And then, and you know, again, couldn't agree more about Santa Barbara. And it looks like, you know, the Aidan O'Brien rut that he was in, and I forget what the statistic was, but it was like a year and a half or something that he didn't win a single race in North America. That's over. I mean, he's coming in now, and as John said, just, you know, stealing everybody's lunch money type of thing. Then the other, and I know we want to talk about the, you know, the ugly side of the last big day of racing in Arlington Park, which we'll get to that. But the other story, I think, was Chad Brown, too. And, you know, his dominance of these races was almost unprecedented. He'd won the Beverly D five straight times, six overall. Now, remember, no race in 2020 because of COVID. And he had won the last four Arlington Millions. Now, only Chad Brown can win a grade three on the card and have a bad day. Exactly. He won the grade three, the Pucker Up Stakes with a more modest horse, but failed to win in those other races. So, you know, when we think Chad Brown is invincible, we see that even he has an occasional bad day.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's good for the game to see other trainers coming in and winning these big turf races, because, you know, nothing against Chad, but I don't think one trainer dominating any division is great for the sport. I think it's better to have a little parity, just like it is in any sport. It's better to have parity instead of one or two teams dominating for years and years. But yeah, I mean, the other part, the like what Bill brought up, the kind of the ugliness of the last day at Arlington Park. And we talked about this a little bit. You know, I took a trip to Arlington earlier this year, and it's such a beautiful racetrack, and there's just absolutely no good reason for it to be closing down. But beyond that, I actually didn't see this on Saturday because I was out at the track, but apparently they were rushing people out of the building. And
yeah, Joe, here's the story on this. And you know, as media members here, we're not asking people to feel sorry for us, but, you know, media members should be allowed to do their job. And I've covered not just horse racing, I've covered every sport that there is. And what they do is the press box doesn't have an opening time and a closing right. time. If the game is over at 11 o'clock and it takes you 5 hours to write your story, then the press box closes when you're done and when you leave. So Arlington Park and their guy that's their president or general manager, a guy by the name of Tony Petrillo, to just add insult to injury, what a petulant, just mean-spirited move that he pulled. There was apparently 9 people that are covering the Arlington Million, which in and of itself is a story, because 20 years ago there would have been 50 covering the race. And within 90 minutes after the race, he threw them out of the track, the people in the press box. He even told a photographer by the name of Jamie Newell that she was banned for life. Horse racing, we don't ban Jason Service and Jorge Navarro from the racetrack, but we ban a photographer from life, Arlington Park. So, you know, and everybody obviously is very sad about Arlington's demise. And, you know, we can point fingers at Churchill Downs is where the finger obviously deserved to be pointed. But, you know, what on earth would they do something like this for? And again, it just strikes, I don't know the guy, but it just strikes me as, you know, just a nasty thing to do. And just to just dig the knife in just a little bit more. Hey, we're closing Arlington and get the hell out.
Yeah, it's so weird too, because, you know, we thought that Churchill and the people in charge of Arlington were going to try to finesse this closing a little bit to keep some goodwill in the industry. And that's the opposite of that.
They couldn't care less.
Like kick them on the way out the door. I do want to mention that Alan Carrasso, our senior editor at TDN, was at Arlington over the weekend, had some great coverage. He had a great story as well on Sunday because he's a Chicago guy. So it was definitely very bittersweet for him. And it was great. He was talking about how you know, how he grew up going to Arlington Park and all the memories and how what a sad goodbye it was. So his coverage was great. But yeah, it just seems so, the closing of Arlington in general seems so unnecessary, but also to treat people like that on the way out the door is just incredibly unnecessary. And, you know, I think that track deserved better. I think the people who were covering the race deserve better. And I think Illinois racing overall deserves a lot better than the way it's been treated the last couple of years. But
have you guys ever been to a facility when they're closing it down? Have you ever been to a racetrack where they were closing it down? It's
I've been to the last day ever at Suffolk Downs, for what it's worth. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was at the last day of Atlantic City's racing, and literally we were running a horse in a race, and people were walking in with tool belts and vans outside, and were taking pieces of the grandstand, taking pieces of the paddock, taking the trophies off the walls with electric screwdrivers. Oh, I mean, it was so. Not that I'm saying that that's what this guy had in mind when he was kicking out the press. But I'm sure he was like, that's it. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. I'm turning off the lights.
But John, there's still a month and a half of racing
left. It wasn't the closing day of the track.
Yeah. So Alan Carrasco did not show up with a tool belt.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, that reminds me, I was at the last game at the old Meadowlands, and there were fans ripping up the seats on the way out the door. I don't know what that could have been about other than they were pissed off that everybody was being so waxing so nostalgic about Arlington and Arlington closing. That's the only thing I could think of, that that's some kind of retributive thing for people, you know, lamenting the fact that Arlington's closing.
Right. I can understand they threw us out of the press box,
we got like a half hour before they throw us out.
Before they throw us out of here. Yeah, exactly. That's true.
So let's wrap up this segment. But yeah, I mean, very sad day, but I thought some satisfying results in terms of local connections winning and a lot of different trainers, a lot of different horses coming from different directions at Arlington. I thought it was a great day of racing. It's unfortunate that there won't be another Arlington Million Day. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Spendthrift. Big week for Spendthrift High Oak, who we talked about before. Very, very impressive winning the Saratoga Special. Son of Spendthrift's first crop sire, Gormley, for first juveniles on the track this year. He's already got 6 winners, and now I think really has that breakout performer that we love to see this early in the year. He's undefeated, 2 starts for Bill Mott. And Spendthrift also got a win in the next race at Saratoga with God Stormy, which we also mentioned before. And it was great for Spendthrift to come back with her and race her, because like I said, she's a very popular mare. And also at the facing sale earlier this week, at the New York Bred Sale yesterday and Sunday, Cloud Computing, there was a Cloud Computing horse that brought $225,000. Very, very nice for a first crop yearling sire, sold to Eddie Woods. And another Spendthrift first crop yearling sire who we talked about a lot, had a lot of buzz, Bolt Doro, kind of really lived up to the hype there. 200,000, 170,000, and 140,000 yearlings at the New York Bred Sale. What was your impression?
Yeah, and that's coming off the Phasic Tipton July sale, where Bolt Doro averaged $130,000 for the 3 or 4 yearlings that sold there. So obviously they're putting their best foot forward. They have some really impressive Bolt Doros. The buzz was all about Bolt Doro as far as being a freshman sire and just how good looking those athletes looked. And the Cloud Computing that sold for 2.25, we actually looked at outstanding. A really, really good looking yearling.
Yeah, I thought that horse looked very good too. And also Golden Sense, don't want to slight him. He had a pair of fillies run 1-2 in the debutante stakes at Ellis Park over the weekend.
Take part in the Keeneland November experience this fall. Entry deadline for the Keeneland November sale is Monday, August 2nd. Learn more at november.keeneland.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we're super thrilled this week to bring in our Green Group Guest of the Week, the big cheese over here at NYRA, the CEO of the New York Racing Association, David O'Rourke. Thanks for coming on, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and especially after yesterday at the Racing and Gaming Conference, I thought you had some really interesting comments. And you said about Haiza. We talk a lot about Haiza on the show and the likelihood of it being enacted on time. But you talked about the moral obligation to protect horses, which I think that we harp on a lot. Can you just expound on that? And, after yesterday, what is your sense of how quickly we can get this thing enacted?
I was a little surprised on the debate because I didn't focus really on that aspect. And a lot of it's like the challenges that are coming. After the roundtable, some of the things that Stuart Janney had mentioned, that how many people would kind of attack the legislation. And it was a little eye-opening to hear some of that debate yesterday. But, fundamentally, it's just about protecting the horse and our ability to you know, control medication or regulate it uniformly across jurisdictions. I think it's not lost on anyone that it's a challenge on the racetrack side because we are a national sport. People are racing in one jurisdiction. We have a show, like, right here on this set. I'm kind of glad to be on it. Yeah. Andy's never let me sit here. So, you know, we have a show. We'll be showing a race in one jurisdiction. And, you know, unfortunately, things happen. And then when it translates back to ours, it's hard to explain it because it's not, you know, everyone's used to leagues.
Yeah.
And it's uniform across the league. And we haven't had that. And I think HISA will kind of move us into that. Well, it will. It'll move us into that direction. And it'll just give us a better ability to regulate the sport.
Right.
David, first of all, thanks for joining us. And I want to continue. You had a lot of interesting things to say yesterday at the Saratoga Gaming Conference. And your comments on HISA were eye-opening. And, you know, I think you're preaching to the choir here among people that love the game and love the horse and everything. Another thing you touched upon was sports betting and what it may mean for horse racing. And you talked about some things that I necessarily hadn't contemplated, but I think you used something, in fact, that says sports betting is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for the sport, whereas there's some other people that are thinking it's this kind of competition that's going to, you know, prove to, you know, be a big behemoth that racing can't compete with. So could you just expound on that and you know, and again, and also get into, please, the whole idea of having fixed odds wagering, but why you see sports betting and, I guess, piggybacking off sports betting is ultimately a great opportunity for the sport.
So it's change. You know, it's going to change the marketplace. It's, you know, you look at it one way, it's going to expand the marketplace in terms of people participating in an activity that's very similar to everything that we've been doing for a long, long time. So there's concerns because it's different. But if you look at the market, it's been 10, 11 billion for the last decade, almost my entire time I've been here at NYRA. And if we don't do anything different, what do we expect tomorrow? And with the influx of customers on these platforms and with, you know, with getting our sport out onto the mainstream sports television, I see it as a perfect opportunity. Are there risks? Yes. There's always risk when it gets down to making a change and then changing our product offering.
Right.
So do I know exactly how this play out? Obviously not, but I do see it as a huge opportunity. There's, I mean, literally millions of customers there. We've got our product in front of them in terms of the shows. Mm-hmm. Now let's get our wagering product in front of them as well.
Right.
I mean, that's as simple as it sounds. That's really the play.
Okay. And another thing I want to say on the same sort of follow-up question, if you don't mind. You know, we all know that if we have just put fixed odds wagering on NYRA bets, Twin Spires, Express Bet, it's probably not going to do the sport a whole lot of good. It's going to be the same people just betting in a different way. How do we get sports betting onto FanDuel, DraftKings, MGM, et cetera, so that a guy can bet the Knicks at +6 and also bet Knicks Go at, you know, -120 or whatever to win the Whitney?
I wouldn't say that fixed odds wouldn't be on NYRA bets, but that okay. isn't the play. It
exactly.
is to get
yeah.
onto those
yeah.
platforms because those folks are doing a ton to market. They're collecting a group of customers that's difficult for us to reach. Their marketing budgets are massive. They're in acquisition mode. If you just look at the valuations of some of these companies and their earnings, it shows you what stage of the development that they're in, and that's in growth. So, you know, we view it exactly that way. FanDuel, DraftKings, PointsBet, Bet365. These are all big players in other markets. They're going to be big players in our market. They offer racing in other markets. They should, in my opinion, offer racing in our market. And it's a massive distribution channel. It's about distribution, and it's really just coming out right in front of us. I mean, that's the way I see it.
And Dave, now that you've been NYRA president and CEO for a number of years, give us an idea of what's been your biggest challenge and also what's been your greatest accomplishment in that period of time.
The biggest challenge? Really going back to HISA and the safety of the horse, you know, when I came on in terms of CEO, it's 2019, and we were having the industry was having an inflection moment, really, in terms of that. We started with the Breeders' Cup and some other tracks, the Safety Coalition. So it was really just doubling down the focus of the safety of the athlete, and HISA eventually got passed. So that's challenged. I'd say that was the biggest challenge, but I think it was good for me. Because it refocused. I came from the finance side, a lot of content, wagering, what we were just talking about, and this really pushed me right into the other side of the sport, and it gave me an opportunity to learn a ton really fast and kind of set my compass in terms of what I needed to focus on. Accomplishments? I don't know, I'm still here.
not bad for an IRC.
Yeah, yeah. That's yet to play out. I've had some theories on the sports betting. Hopefully I'm right. I could be wrong. We've been pushing the television product, been working on that before I was CEO with Olivotto. I think that's one of our biggest accomplishments in the near term. And it's how do we translate that into the bigger play, which would be to, if you look from the top line, a few things like Saratoga, we're talking about handle records, but in your mind, you always set a goal. So the goal here would be $1 billion. And it's going to take a while, but I believe we can get there. If you're looking at the overall market at $10 billion or $11 billion, let's double it. So how do we actually get there? And the biggest way to get there is increase the customer base is job one. So we see a play right now where there's an opportunity for that for the sport.
Well, you mentioned Saratoga, and Saratoga is obviously all good for NYRA. It's a great experience for everybody. I think you guys do well up here, obviously. But it's a little bit more challenging, I think, to manage Belmont and Aqueduct downstate. And you mentioned at the conference yesterday the idea of maybe consolidating racing downstate. I grew up going to Aqueduct, but I'm realistic about the idea that having two tracks 8 miles apart doesn't necessarily make sense long term. And you talked about maybe winterizing Belmont Park. We saw Gulfstream recently say that they were going to put a third surface in, or were going to put a synthetic track in. Is that something you guys are considering for Belmont in terms of whether or not you're able to run year round?
A synthetic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it actually is in the conversation.
Yeah.
As I mentioned yesterday, and on the Jockey Club, was putting a tunnel in on the north side, pedestrian tunnel on the south side, possibly a horse tunnel in the same configuration. But that's currently what's in process. This winter, the focus will go right back to Belmont. Pre-COVID, that was a very big focus of ours, working on that project, and we're picking that back up. Job one there is the surfaces. We know we want to build the tunnel in. The configurations will come within the next year, and a synthetic is one of the options on the table for sure. It could even be a fourth track. So huge there that we have the space for it.
Yeah.
Which would mean it would be dirt, turf, synthetic.
Okay.
But there's some other ones that I could lay out, but this would be a great one if you ever want to have Glenn Kozak on, because we could really go through the different options on this one.
Right, and I think that's good. I think that's the way forward for a lot of tracks.
Dave, I want to stay on the same subject, and I know you don't have all the answers at this point, but again, something you mentioned yesterday, and you said something that is very obvious. Really, is there any point having two racetracks 8 miles apart? Mm-hmm. So I know there's, you talked about a couple different possibilities, but 10 years from now, 5 years from now, et cetera, what do you think is going to be the footprint or whatever of the two downstate racetracks? Will there be both? I assume if one is to go, it would be Aqueduct. If that were to happen, what might you need you to do to make Belmont a 10-month-a-year facility, et cetera, like that? So if you could just sort of speculate about the possibilities for the future of those two tracks.
So 5-10 years out, I think there'll be one facility. I think it'll be Belmont Park. That's really our hub. We're training there right now. So a smaller footprint. Now, that could mean two different things. It could mean literally a smaller building, mm-hmm. or it could mean the first and second floor of the clubhouse, which would be adequate for winter racing. So that's really what we're going to attack in terms of planning this winter. What are our options? There's really three. You could say you can knock it down and build a smaller building, you can redo it, or you can take more of a overtime approach. And one of the things we did this year was create, I think it's called the Triple Crown Room on the second floor. And that was, in a sense, an experiment. What would it start to look like if we did take sections of this building and build out rooms that, we need for big dates like Belmont Stakes mm-hmm. Day or potential Breeders' Cup? So those answers will start to flow out. But what you're looking at is a smaller conditioned footprint at Belmont for 10 months a year, and the ability to expand out for something like the Belmont Stakes or Breeders' Cup.
John?
And Dave, the only other question I have for you is, a couple of weeks ago, I thought it was a surprise. We kind of got a surprise announcement that Martin Panza was stepping down. What has he brought to the table? And also, do you have any, can you give us any idea of who you think would be, filling his shoes?
Martin's he's actually taught me a ton. So he's been here since, I think, 2013. He redefined our program in a lot of ways and created what we have today. So You know, I couldn't be more thankful to have this time to work with Martin. It's a tough job, running racing. It really is. There's a, you know, and after a while, a change of scenery might be a good thing for someone because it can wear you out. It's day in and day out. We race so much here. So he's leaving our program in great shape. We are recruiting right now. I don't have a specific answer for you yet, but I probably would love to make an announcement in the near future. But we'll be in safe hands. Martin's here through the Breeders' Cup, and he's going to help with any kind of transition. So, you know, hats off to what Martin's done, though, because these numbers and any ability or trajectory to ever get to $1 billion here, I know it's a big number. He's set us on a course for that.
Yeah. Just one more question from me. You mentioned also yesterday the limiting of computer wagering. I think that's been a big bugaboo for a lot of you know, meat and potatoes bettors, the late odds drops. You said that you guys are limiting computer wagers to 2 minutes to post. What are the logistics of that, and why do you think that was so important for Naira to take the lead on that?
We had an odds drop. It might have been the second week on a Saturday, and I get these calls, texts a lot, and you know, as sports betting's rolling out and we have this conversation about fixed odds and, you know, why would anybody want a fixed odds bet? There's nothing wrong with parimutuel in a lot of ways, but what's the best product mix? Parimutuel exotics are great. You can't match them in terms of risk, reward, and potential value. Our whips, you know, the odds movement agitates people, and a lot of it's late money coming into the pool. So, you know, we basically said 2 minutes out, that's it. And I don't even think they're wagering into those pools because their algorithms require, you know, they're looking for value mm-hmm. at a sense. So I don't think they're even in the pool right now. They are in other pools. They add a lot of liquidity to pools. This is a balance.
Right.
This
no, that's
isn't,
why it's tough.
This isn't, you know, the idea of like eradicating something yeah. from our pools, but it's a balance. And one of the things you want to bring to the player is the ability for them to extract value. So we, you know, we have certain pools that we limit to retail, and we think it's a balanced mix out there. And, you know, as the product progresses into what I was just speaking with Bill about is the exotics are where probably our future is parimutuelly. So let's see how best we can deliver that product, because we're going to rely on that. Mm-hmm. People come in through whips, they'll come in through fixed odds or proposition bets. But if they're going to go down the value chain and become, you know, serious players, we have to get them into our you know, trifectas, horizontals, and right. that.
Gotcha. I want to stay on that same subject, David, and I want to ask you this from a Naira perspective, but from the racing industry as a whole. And I should commend you guys because, as far as I know, you're the only track that is out there limiting some of these pools and not allowing the computer guys to get into it. But to me, for horse racing, this is the ultimate damned if you do, damned if you don't. I mean, you would know better than me, but I think the estimates are that the computer guys now account for about 35% of all the handle bet at major racetracks like this. You don't want that handle to go away, obviously. But at the same time, in the parimutuel system, they're cleaning everybody's clock. They're cleaning John's clock, my clock. And the guy, even big bettors, guys that might wager $2,000 or $3,000 a day, are losing more now than they may have before these guys came around because they're simply, you know, taking a bigger slice of the pie than everybody else. So you either get rid of them and you lose a ton of handle, or you let them keep going and you drive a lot of players out of the game. What is the answer to that? Okay.
10 so, words or less.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what really happens is the payouts are muted. Mm-hmm. You lose volatility in the payouts just because the way parimutuel works. You're not like, so the players get, you could say they get ground out quicker is really what you're,
right,
you're
exactly.
getting towards. I think it's just a balance. I think 35, that's a big number.
Do you think it's less than that then?
It can be. I mean, at ours it is for
okay.
sure. A lot,
sure.
actually.
Okay.
So there is a certain mix where it actually is healthy to keep the pools at certain levels because they're consistent in terms of the amount that the volume that they'll bet. I mean, if you look at the financial markets, there's similar arguments that have occurred over time in terms of professionals in the system. They provide liquidity for the pools. So it's not all negative, but 35% is a lot.
Okay.
I mean, that's all I would say. That's a high number mm-hmm. that I don't think that's a sustainable number.
All right, well, Dave, thanks so much for stopping by. We appreciate all the insight and keep fighting the good fight on Heizo as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. good luck to the rest of the meet as well. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, David O'Rourke will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
So we're thrilled to welcome to the desk right here, Andy Serling, handicapper extraordinaire, Saratoga Institution, wearing a sweater while I'm clearly sweating through my shirt here.
Well, I was just riding my bike over to see my mom and kind of warmed up in the tent a little. You guys are making it so hot in the tent with all this great stuff going on here.
Yeah, of course. We're honored to be on this set. I wanted to ask you this personally, like a personal question, because we asked Acacia, we asked Maggie this, about the difference this year and last year at Saratoga. Obviously, there's a huge difference, but you're a guy that's been coming to Saratoga for decades, so it's steeped, it's in your blood. How do you feel this year compared to last year? How much has it meant to have everyone back?
I don't think you realized last year how sort of depressing it was in a way, because we were grateful to be here. I was grateful to be here. I kept thinking to myself, if this was a normal situation, I wasn't working at NYRA and Saratoga was running and fans were allowed to go, I've been unbelievably miserable, even if I was able to watch on TV, because being here is incredibly fun. I mean, Bill's been coming here forever and he knows how much fun it could be to be here. And you know, Saratoga's a place where all the people come. They don't come to tracks that much during the year, but everybody shows up for some period of time during Saratoga, and it's a very festive situation. So I was happy to be here in that situation and glad that we could be here, because I feel like NYRA being here answered the question of our commitment to Saratoga. And imagine if we hadn't come last summer, the entire year would have been, will they be back next summer? But because we were here last summer, nobody asked that question. We showed our commitment regardless of circumstance. So for that reason, I was so glad that we were able to come here. My mom is here. She's getting older. It's nice to spend time with her. So all of that stuff was good. And it was just so nice being up in Saratoga after being in the city for a while. So you almost didn't notice just how depressing it was here that you didn't see anybody, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a trainer would come over for a race or two they were in, and maybe if I was off the air, I'd see Chad Brown or Christophe Clement or any number of people I'm friendly with. Very few owners here, good friends of mine that come up every year. So as it wore on, it was just like, you know, there's only so much. The poor jockeys, they only had me to talk about, and they can't stand me. So it was so depressing for them. They ended up talking to me probably more than anybody else. So, you know, it was sort of an unbelievably odd situation, right? It's like, you know, it's kind of like that situation of, you know, you ever walk through an airport and you see somebody you're familiar with and you go, hey, you wave, and then you realize, I hate that person. I never talk to them in real life. But it's that unfamiliarity thing. Yeah. So then we get up here and we're back to normal. I mean, essentially, this is what it's been like for our whole lives being here. And it's just like, oh man, it feels like a bad dream, you know? So that bad dream is, at least that part of it is over, and it's just nice to be back to normal in Saratoga and enjoying a great summer up here.
So Andy, you kind of touched on some of this, but I'll ask you, there are thousands of racing talking heads out there. Most of them are pretty vanilla. You are anything but. You have an opinion, you'll express your opinion. And I was just wondering, first of all, why do you think it's important to present yourself and present your arguments about races and jockeys, et cetera, that way? And do you get a lot of blowback, be it from a jockey you might have criticized or maybe a phone call from somebody at NYRA saying, you know, this really important owner is really pissed that you said this about his horse, stop, or anything like that?
No, I never get that from NYRA.
Okay.
You know, between Tony Alvato and Dave O'Rourke, who I work with, they have my back absolutely. I mean, listen, if they felt like I said something out of line, Tony might say, you might want to tone that down a little bit, but he would be right if he said it. You know what I mean? I would feel as though, and I feel like I'm pretty good about not doing that. I don't really understand this whole notion that I'm this incredibly outspoken person, because I've been betting the horses my whole life. I grew up with my friends in Saratoga. You're an argumentative guy. I know you pretty well. You're an argumentative guy. But that's what we do, right? Isn't that what we kind of like about racing?
Yeah.
That we have different opinions. We throw them around. We say, you're an idiot. I'm an idiot. This or that. I think that. And then they run the race and we're probably both wrong and whatever. Mm-hmm. You move on or you try to learn from it. So to me, I don't understand this argument. And the thing that's funny to me is
obviously I get a lot of traction on social media, different people, you know, when I'm picking fairly well, I see less. The minute I start kind of picking a little lousy like Specs Weekend, you know, people are coming out of the woodwork. What do they want? Do they want these people that go, I like the two, you know, or yeah. I like the 4-5 favorite, or I don't dislike anybody, they're all beautiful, I hope, you know, whatever it is. Those people, nobody's talking. I mean, I don't want to criticize anybody that works, that does what I do. People do what works for them. But for me, I thought it was what makes racing fun, the disagreements. I work with Stabile. I mean, he's worse than me, Frank. You know Stabile, and, you know, and he and I are great friends.
How many lunches are you on to now?
He's been on a little run. I think he's cut about six off, actually. Right. But I thought that's what people want to do about racing, is argue about it. So I'm not going to change what I do. It seems to be working. I mean, at least they're listening. You know, love, hate, they're all the same, right?
Right. No, absolutely. And one of the things that we talk about on the show a lot also is, you know, when there's trainers that improve on horses and you just go, come on, how are they doing it? And you've been also very outspoken about certain trainers and you know, how they've been able to move horses up. And you do get blowback from that, which we also appreciate. But, you know, what is going to what makes you decide, hey, I'm going to go ahead and say what I think about this, you know, this particular trainer?
I have incredible thought process. I mean, if you're watching a race and you see an unusual form reversal, you immediately, and we see them sometimes. Now, listen, sometimes you say, well, this horse has been X, Y, Z. I'm not surprised the horse moved up. When you see a trainer might be having a number of horses doing it, you're more cognizant of it. I don't think it's any different than handicappers looking at it. So we had one horse that wanted this meet that was a total form reversal, and I pointed out, I don't think there's anything wrong with what I said. I didn't accuse somebody of doing something, nor am I accusing anybody of doing it. But to deny that what you saw on the racetrack happened and to pretend it's not happening isn't fair. Now, listen, I'm careful about it. The last thing I want to do is accuse people. And I find that there's a lot of willy-nilly accusations thrown at people that are completely irresponsible about a lot of trainers in this game. But, you know, I pointed out about Jason Service on a number of occasions in the past. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back for doing it. And I did get a hard time from some people at times doing it. Not the people, once again, my employers, Naira, they never had a problem. Nobody ever said anything. And I would just say, like, you know, you can't use the PPs to handicap their horses. They'll improve from one start to the next. They'll run well. They won't run well. And so, I mean, I'm not trying to say, I'm certainly not the be-all and end-all, but I do think in looking at performance improvements, looking at speed figures, and looking at those things are one thing that indicates. Now, listen, any trainer, a good trainer, can get one horse and figure out that whatever, there was an issue with it and something, and turn it around. It's like, I'll give you a good example of that. You hear a lot of talk about Brad Cox and Nick's Go. Nick's Go was a grade one winner as a two-year-old and finished second in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. It's not like he was some $25,000 claimer that never showed the ability. And there is a very fair argument for Brad Cox that he got this horse, gave him some time, and said, this is a horse that wants to run fast early and outruns, which by the way, we don't see very often racing these days. That's nobody seems thing. To want to do that. Nobody wants to go to the front anymore. They're all afraid that that's a bad thing. So I hear a lot of talk, and to me, okay, I don't, you know, I'm not saying, people would say whatever they want, but to me, I see a trainer that figured his horse out and got him to get back to what he was doing as a two-year-old that proved successful in a grade one race, and to suggest that, oh, this guy is a cheat because he, I don't know, why don't all of his horses run like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was saying this the other day, I was on Bick's show, and I was talking about the era of suspicion, where it's, racing has let obvious cheaters off the hook for so long that it breeds suspicion of any move up. And that's not necessarily the case. There are plenty of, you know, honest horsemanship that moves horses up for one reason or another. I haven't really heard you talk about Heisa and the reform that's potentially come into racing. I don't know, maybe I haven't watched the right stuff.
Haven't.
But so let's get you on the record now. How do you feel about that? Do you think that this is going to cure most of what ills the sport in that way?
Well, I've been around a long time. I'm old like Bill. So I've heard a lot of things over the years, and I would love to see the sport cleaned up. If somebody's out there cheating, they're actually using performance-enhancing drugs of some kind, they're stealing money from everybody here, everybody out there, from owners, from bettors, and they're cheating the game.
Yeah, right.
I love the game. Whatever it is, at the end of the day, I love the game. I think it's the greatest thing that happened in my life. My life is great because of horse racing. And so if somebody is cheating the game, there's nothing that we can do to them to be too much, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
And if Heisa can help and do that, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
I don't have a real opinion, except that people I respect think it's the right thing to do, and I'm willing to defer to them. And I do agree with the argument that we have had our chances to police things, and we have failed miserably.
Yep.
State
yep.
to state, yep. we never agree on anything. There's infighting now about this stuff. So I don't know what argument we have that this shouldn't happen, because we've asked for it. We're like a misbehaving child
exactly.
that eventually somebody has to come in and crack down on us. Eventually they send you to one of those camps out in Utah, right? Well, maybe we need to send us to one of those camps.
But yeah, I mean, and the people that are suing to stop it, there's never an argument for the current system. That's how you can tell
yeah.
that it's broken, because it's always just, well, this is unconstitutional. Okay, so what do you want to do? Well, I don't know about that. We haven't considered that. Bill?
Yeah, Andy, switching gears a little bit, your work has now been broadened by the Fox Sports broadcast. I mean, just something that was unimaginable, you know, when you and I were young guys running around the street, you know, what we're going to have horse racing on every single day. But, you know, so we know it's a good thing, but what is your sense about what this has done for NYRA? I mean, when we see, I think the number was like 37 million on Whitney Day, which is, for a non-Travers Day, is astronomical figure. So, you know, what's your sense, maybe it's just anecdotal or whatever, what this broadcast has meant for the New York Racing Association, and has it achieved one of its main goals, to get new fans to the sport?
Well, there's a lot of questions in there. I think it's undeniable that it is, it's elevated our signal. As you know, for much of the year, we're the number one signal anyway. But when you look at the numbers and you look at a Saratoga, and we're out handling the next four tracks combined, it's clear that the eyes are on Saratoga and their eyes are on our racing, and the Belmont numbers have been good. Aqueduct numbers were very good. You know, you think about how good the fall meeting's been at Aqueduct the last couple of years, and the weather holds up. And I think the show has, I mean, you have to ask yourself, why has this happened? So it would be unreasonable to say the show doesn't play some role. I'm not going to pat myself or the people in the back and say, oh, we're responsible for all this, because a lot of people are doing a lot of good things in NYRA. And to say that it's just the show and everybody else is just window dressing is unfair. I think NYRA, especially with Dave O'Rourke, is doing a very good job of trying to do the right thing. And I think some of that's come out recently, so that may play a role. But clearly, controlling our signal in this very positive way on Fox directly to people has put more eyes specifically on NYRA, as opposed to having to look and hope the races are shown live, or when they're shown, they're watching the show and more people are watching. So clearly you would think the television show has played a role, and it's made us a signal that more people are specifically paying attention to. I don't think you can ignore that. What was the other part you said?
So you're getting greater market share,
right?
But that's, you know, admirable. But an even more admirable goal, I think, would be to get new fans for a sport that's had a very hard time getting new fans. Do you think this is helping?
I don't know. That's a good question. And the last thing I want to do is say, oh, we're doing this great job bringing new fans in, because, you know, I think one of the problems racing has had, and once again, I don't mean keen to say you guys are children and we've been around for 100 years. I envy you're being younger than me. Is racing's had a bad habit of trying to bring new fans in while treating their old fans poorly, and they bring new fans in, they treat them poorly too. That's not, you know, let's figure out how to treat the people who've been around for a while properly, and then we'll worry about new fans. Are we bringing in new fans? I think the pandemic was a bit of a possibility. It got some new eyes on it.
Yeah.
So hopefully they are staying with us a little bit as sports have come back. Obviously Saratoga is the one place, more than any other track, more than Keeneland, of bringing in new people who might get interested in racing. Now that number might be 3 out of 1,000. I don't know what it is. I'm okay with that.
Yeah,
I'm okay
right.
with the small numbers, making better fans. You know, I saw some clown on Twitter criticizing me for saying, I see my job as helping people lose less. I think if you don't understand that, you don't really understand the game, because I think if we educate people well, they'll have better opinions. Now, it's a double-edged sword. The better your opinion overall, the more tough beats you'll take, the more times you'll be frustrated, because the better your horse will run, because vice versa, if your opinion stinks, your horse will be running 6th and 7th all the time and you'll never really be there, but that's no fun.
Yeah,
so our hope is to elevate people enough that they're making better selections and their horses are running well enough that maybe they're not always winning, but they're looking and going, that horse ran well, he could have won, or they're getting a little. So I think the idea is to elevate people's play to get them more involved. Now that may bring in some frustrations, but better to be frustrated your horse could have won the race and ran 2nd or 3rd than you're always betting horses running 8th. If you do that, you're not going to come back. So hopefully we're getting people into a place where they can have a better idea of what's going on, and that can make better fans. How successful we're being, that's very hard for me to measure or know.
So you get the racing form, you know, for this weekend at Saratoga, and you're starting to go through it. Give our audience an idea of what are the what's the first or second thing that you're looking at in the form that's going to make you, you know, tip either way as far as who you're going to bet?
Oh, the first thing I'm looking at, I'm just running through the PPs, looking for replays and, right. you know, and stuff I need to look up on Formulator and things like that. And, you know, I'm not even, you know, pedigree stuff, and I'm not even at time form. And I mean, the basic thing I think that anyone should look at first glance is there a lot of speed? Is there no speed? Right. You know, how's the race set up? Who's it looking to help? And sort of highlight them. But then I go and I use Timeform US to put in the pace projector and look at that and sort of look at their figures to compare them to the buyer figures, which I use, and see if they have some real discrepancies. And then I just sort of use Formulator. I watch a bunch of replays and I try to put it all together. Right. But it's a process. I mean, it's a process that works for me. And a lot of what I do, excuse me, let's face it, there are going to be races that any person's going to look at and go, I have absolutely no idea who's going to win this race. And you usually know that fairly early. Now, occasionally you'll look and you'll come pretty early. I'm on TV, I have to talk about those races. So I'm going to look, those are the ones I spend more time on. But a lot of what I'm spending time on is for my job here. Right. And I try to portray, there was a race on Sunday, an 8-horse field where I narrowed down to 5. The exacta were 2 of the 3 I didn't like. And I said, look, I have no idea. You know, I'm doing the best I can here. And it turned out, and I wasn't surprised. It's not a race. I hope that people understand when I say that I'm probably not looking to bet that race.
Right.
But a lot of the work I do is just, a lot of it is for the TV show,
right.
more so than my handicap. And they're two separate things.
Well, that leaves you open to a lot, because you have to have an opinion on every race. You know, when you're a regular horse player at the track, past races, this is a different beast.
Yeah, and what about for baby races, especially here at Saratoga? I mean, what's gonna tip you off? Is it trainer jockey combination? Is it breeding? Is it going back and watching the under tack show videos? What are you looking at?
I watch the videos, the 2-year-old sales. Some of them come out of. I look up the pedigrees to see if there's any precocity or, you know, past horses, just to sort of know some crap to talk about in the air. And I don't look at the workout reports, but I'll talk to a friend sometimes a day of and get some, like, if there were any big workout situation. That's more to know who's likely to take money and sort of have an idea on that. So I have an overview to talk about. I don't want tips. Whether you think my opinion is good or bad is fine. I don't think people want me to come up here and saying I have a tip on the 4. I mean, they can get that horrible information on their own or not, or hopefully not. So I try to, you know, when somebody says to me, I'm going to give you a horse, but you can't say it. No, I'm going to say it on the air if you say it. So don't even say it. I don't want to hear it. And I'm not missing anything. You've been around the track. You don't miss anything when you don't get tips.
Yeah.
I have some close friends who have horses, so occasionally I know about their horses. But in this case, they're usually a very short price anyway, so people don't need me to tell me those horses can run.
Right.
I wanted to ask about this because we just had your boss, David O'Rourke, on. He made sure to tell me, to ask me to tell you he was the guest of the week. So you're following
the
him.
The warm-up act comes first.
That's what I said to him.
Dave wants to cut that.
That's what I said to him.
I did want to see Soundgarden warm up for Guns N' Roses, so there is that odd situation, but Dave's a warm-up. He'll always be one.
You guys can hammer that out later. But one of the things I asked him about, one of the things he talked about yesterday at this racing and gaming conference, was Belmont and Aqueduct and the idea of eventually maybe consolidating racing at Belmont. As a guy who spends a lot of time downstate at Belmont and Aqueduct, when I see you out there in your wool hat in the middle of winter, I'm like, that's a hardcore New York horse player, and I really appreciate that as a guy who spent a lot of time there. But so what's your opinion? Like, do you think that that's the future, and how would you feel if eventually racing is consolidated at Belmont?
Look, I love Aqueduct. I know that Aqueduct is the most unfairly maligned racetrack. It's a city racetrack. It's never been anything other than a city racetrack, but Bill used to come out every day. We spent a lot of time at Aqueduct in the winter, and there's something to me that I find oddly romantic about taking the subway to Aqueduct, getting home from there, taking the subway. It's very convenient for me living in the Upper West Side in Manhattan. So I love Aqueduct. And I think the racing, if people have been paying attention, the first 6 weeks in December, when we still have turf racing there, as long as the weather holds up, the racing's been phenomenal there the last few years. Yeah. You really start seeing the 2-year-olds coming out, and the racing is terrific. I get it, though. You're running two big plants 8 miles apart. Why would you want to be paying for both these? It doesn't make economic sense. So I understand what Dave says. I used to think that saying something was above my pay grade was an insult. I've learned in racing to be able to say something's above my pay grade is actually good. That's up to them to decide what's right. I would if and when Aqueduct closes, I will miss it because I love it. And it's the first track I went to in New York. I went with my grandmother in the old Aqueduct Special back in the 70s. So I have a great love for Aqueduct, but that doesn't mean that Dave would be wrong about a business decision that we should make. And as much as I love Belmont Park, and I do love Belmont Park, it's a bit of a dinosaur. I mean, we get filled up one day a year. Yeah. So it would make sense to have a smaller model to make changes there. So I'm behind Dave on all the things he does. I think Dave has a very good understanding of the history of racing a bit. Dave and I are good friends. We spent a lot of time together. So Dave's heard all my BS over the years. And I think he does respect that. He really respects horse racing.
Yeah.
And I hope people realize that. But he also has to run a company, and he has to make business decisions. Yeah. So I don't think he's looking to make changes because he's some sort of, he's cost cutting or whatever. He's trying to make the realistic changes and try to move us forward in a very positive way. That doesn't mean I won't miss Aqueduct, even if I agree with
him. Sure. Yeah, well, that was one of the first tracks I went to. I'm on the A line now, so it's super convenient for me. And I agree, there's something romantic about taking the subway to the racetrack. But yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of tracks and a lot of companies are going to have to move that way eventually in terms of consolidation. It's just the reality of the sport.
Right. I can't stand what they did to Gulfstream in Florida, mostly because I spent some great winters there and I love the old Gulfstream. So call me, romantic, and it's not my place to tell them how to run it.
Yeah.
I wish that they still had the old track. So that's my complaint. It doesn't mean they were wrong.
Right.
A track like Gulfstream, if that was a track that we put where Aqueduct is, it would make a certain amount of sense, tracks like that. So I think these, Aqueduct's obviously different because there are the slots are there and Resorts World's there.
Yeah. And I think if anything, opening that kind of brand new casino has, made such a contrast with Aqueduct, which is so old school, which I like. I think it's charming, but I always say that if you walk through that walkway from the casino to the Aqueduct, it's like going back in time 40 years in a couple minutes.
Yeah. It's weird.
One more trivia question. Yeah. Did you realize that this is the first time in racing and Lehigh University history that two Lehigh grads are on the same panel for a show?
Are you sure of that?
I am sure of that.
Really?
Actually, I went through the archives.
Really?
Yeah, I was a journalism major, so I went through the archives.
Proud moment for Lehigh. This should probably be good for their recruiting.
I'm sure.
I can imagine that they'll probably have more people.
This is how clueless these guys can be, these young guys. I'm just going to pick on John.
I brought up,
you'll know this. Who won the 1972 Sanford Stakes?
Secretariat.
Of course. Can you believe they...
Bill said I was three years old when I was there, and I said, it must be Manowar, because he was 3 years old.
It was the year before.
Right. Yeah.
Aristides won that.
I'm sure you're right, Bill.
Yeah.
Andy, thanks so much for stopping by, man. I really appreciate it. And it's an honor. I'm serious. It's an honor to sit on this show. You guys do a great job.
Appreciate it.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the Minnesota Thoroughbred Association's 2021 Yearling Sale, coming August 29th at Canterbury Park. Quality selection of yearlings from top Kentucky stallions like Taprit, Race Day, Practical Joke, Cross Traffic, and Wicked Strong. Regional yearling sires have proven to be a great source for affordable and classy future racehorses. Download a catalog today at minnesotabred.com. 39 yearlings catalog for the upcoming MTA Minnesota Bred Sale, August 29th, like I said, which will follow the afternoon's races at Canterbury Park. And also some yearlings by Practical Joke, Midshipman, More Spirit, Free Drop Billy, and more. So get involved.
Flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. Backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales, visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
So we're thrilled to welcome to the desk Eclipse champion rider, and one of the leading riders here at Saratoga, this meet Jose Ortiz. Thanks for joining us, man.
Thank you, Joe.
We're glad to have you. So I've been asking everybody this. You rode here at Saratoga last year when there were no fans. What's the atmosphere been like this year compared to that?
Much better. We love the fan and the excitement they bring to the show is just unbelievable.
Does it get you going more when you're like riding through the stretch and can you hear the crowd?
Well, honestly, when I'm on the race, I don't really hear the crowd unless it's a really big race that it really get loud. But other than that, no.
But if you can hear them, does that add to the excitement for you?
Of course,
Yeah.
Sometimes excitement and kind of little nervous, because when they cheering really hard, it's because if you are in front, somebody's coming after you.
Yeah, no doubt.
Okay. Jose, thanks for joining us, first of all. And you've ridden a lot of good horses over the years, but I'm not that I recall, have you ever ridden a horse that may be Horse of the Year? And you have that this year in Latruska. And I know you've only ridden her in her last two starts. Matter of fact, your brother Irad rode her in the Apple Blossom. But, talk about her coming into the personal lens and what it's like to ride a mare that's this good.
Well, she's very, very good, but I don't think I'm riding her next, because if you recall, the Etrusca was a case that I picked up the mount when Ira fell down in Belmont. So I picked up the mount, and then she was gonna run. They wasn't sure if she was gonna run a Churchill, but I was gonna be there anyway to ride Maxfield. So they didn't wanna tie up Ira and then scratch, so I rode the filly again. And now for the personal ensign, I think it's gonna be Ira. But yeah, she's very exciting, and I mean, she's very tough in the division, and the speed that she have and the stamina is, you know, it's a killer. It's hard to keep up with her.
Yeah.
And Jose, as an owner, I always appreciate when I see you on one of my horses. And one of the reasons why I like you on one of our horses is that you have a very good clock in your head. Explain to the audience, you know, how you know when horses in front of you are going so much faster and you can sit chilly, or you need to start, you know, speeding up because it's the pace is so slow.
And just start with the horse that you are riding. If I'm riding a speed horse and I feel like I'm brushing him a little bit to be up close, that means that they're going very fast. If I'm riding a fast horse and they crawl, I have to be pulling him very, very hard. That means that the pace is kind of slow. So, I mean, it's 50-50. You got to be connected with your horse and the horses in front of you too.
Right, right. So you gauge it based on, you know, looking at the racing form in advance and kind of knowing how the race is going to play out in your mind? Is that, and then you compare it to actually what's going on?
Yeah, you got to be prepared for sure. Sometimes you know out there and you know it's not pacing the race.
Right, right.
And, you know, sometimes you think it's not pace, I'm going to try to break. And then you go out to the paddock and the trainer tell you, ah, no, it's not speed in there, but he don't like to run that way. So either way, just try to stick to his game plan. And you know, sometimes people complain, ah, it's not speed on the race. What are they thinking? And this and that. But at the end of the day, you got to follow your instructions.
Yeah. Right.
And if you get beat with your instruction, the trainer not going to be mad at you. But if you decide to be on your own and you get beat, then it's going to be on you, you know?
Yep.
So I wanted to ask, you know, when you and Irad came over, you came straight to New York, toughest colony in America, maybe in the world. A lot of other guys, they started smaller tracks, then they worked their way up to New York. How has that helped you and Irad, you know, kind of get off running? Like, you guys were successful basically from the jump. How did coming to New York right away help your career?
Well, I think Ira came first. He did came straight to New York, but it was very natural talent. He had the talent. He just need to polish a little bit, learn the way the riders ride in the States and the language, and he did. And I think he worked extremely hard, and he deserved everything he got. He earned it.
No, I mean, he's great, but that competition factor, how stiff the competition is, how has that helped you?
Yeah, you get better. When you get competition, you need to get better, and that drive you to get better. In my case, Ira sent me to Parks. He thought if I go to Parks, I could win the Eclipse Award, riding a Parks, riding a 9-pen, and all them tracks around it. I came to New York and win one race, and I have a good offer from a good agent, and I decided to came here. But I was there just for 2 months.
I felt like I remember you being at Aqueduct real early.
Yeah, I came to Aqueduct like March, something like that, March, April,
Jose, we've seen over the last 30, 40 years a progression of just one great rider out of Puerto Rico after another. You have to start with Angel Cordero, you go to John Velasquez, you go to you and your brother now. How much is that due to the jockey school they have there, which is something that really has never happened or to a high degree in the United States? What kind of advantage does it give the young riders coming out of Puerto Rico?
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. I mean, Angel and Johnny set the path for us, and hopefully we're setting the path for the ones coming behind us. And it's good for the school because we work under government funds. So, I mean, if they see results like they're seeing now, they're gonna keep helping the school. So we need that. Yeah. And we work hard for it. I have it on the back of my head, you know? And I know everything I do is gonna be reflect on the school back home, and the kids, they look up to us now. So
right.
It's gotta keep that on the back of your head all the time.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to follow up on that. When you guys do go back to Puerto Rico, are you like local celebrities? Are they like, what's that like?
Yeah, people do know horse racing well there, yeah. and we are pretty well known. Yeah, a little bit. I don't say huge, like all the sports, baseball, boxing is huge back home. Mm-hmm. Basketball, but I think it's pretty good, especially if we go around the track or we go to the track. It's big, yeah.
Joe's asking you that question because the show is shown in Puerto Rico. So when Joe goes to Puerto Rico, he's a celebrity down there. You know, people are buying him drinks and dinner. He wanted to know if it transitioned to the jockeys as well. Other than the New York racetracks, what's your favorite track to ride in and why?
Honestly, Keeneland is a unique track, and it feels like the Saratoga atmosphere, like people, the Keeneland Smiths are pretty nice.
Right, and the fans can get up close and personal there too, right?
Yeah. And it's full every day, it's wild.
Right. Are they nicer, or are they more educated, or are they meaner than New York?
No,
they're
pretty good. Just like New York. New York is good. Over there, it's a very, like you know, Keeneland is like horse country, so people do respect it nicely, and I never had a bad experience out there.
Yeah.
So Jose, the one of the stories of the meet, Luis Saez, you got to tip your hat to him. He's had a tremendous meet. He's got 39 winners right now. You're second with 34. Can he catch him, and how important is it to you to catch him?
I think Saez has been winning for years now.
Yeah.
It don't surprise me. He's a very good jockey. He had a great agent back. Two years ago under Richie DePass. I mean, you make a Hall of Fame of agents, you gotta be there for sure.
Yeah.
And now he made the transition to Kieran, which is a well-known guy around the track, very respected by everybody. And I'm not surprised at the success he's having and the media he's having. He's a great guy, he's young, he rides hard. Would I wanna beat him? Yeah. I want to beat him. It means a lot to me. It's Saratoga. I win 3 titles already. And I know it's not easy. I don't take it for granted. And I mean, if it's his year, let it be. But I'm going to fight for it, you know. Yeah. I got to do it. I think I'm close enough on 5.
Yep.
You know, one day can turn it around.
Yep. So,
had a good day, you know, 4 wins, I'd be at 1.
Yeah.
But the only problem is that he's not going to stop winning.
Of course.
Right. Yeah.
You it's so competitive.
From now on, I have to, like, if he win 1, I have to win 2. If he win 2, I have to win 3.
Right.
Because he's not going to stop winning.
So that's how you think going into the days?
Honestly, I just go out there and ride my horses.
Yeah.
I think the most pressure you put in your head, I mean, the results are not going to be very good. Then you got to ride loose, and that's what I try to do every day.
Yeah, right. I mean, the last question for me, you know, people see the end result. They see you during the day riding horses in the winner's circle, but there's a lot of work that goes into it in the mornings. You know, can you talk about the dedication it takes to be a top jockey in America?
Yeah, it takes a lot. Like you say, the morning works, the preparation you got to do before, you got to stay healthy, you got to stay in weight, you got to stay in shape. And the mental, you gotta be mentally right to come out here and perform and do well. It's not easy. You're gonna be taking off horses every day. Like, they're gonna take you off one, they're gonna push you on one. So when they take you off a good one, you cannot come here and ride mad all day because it's not gonna go well. I think that mentally, you gotta be in the right place and you gotta be in good shape to be riding, you know.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot, like you say. It's not easy, and it's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, you know, behind the afternoons.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely killing it this meet. We appreciate you stopping by the desk, and good to talk to you. Good luck the rest of the meet. Stay healthy. Keep killing it, man.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it, man. Good stuff. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on every horse as if they were their own. And the entries are out for the Keeneland September sale. We mentioned that before. And Legacy's roster includes yearlings by First Crop Sires Mendelssohn, very popular at the sales, City of Light, Always Dreaming, Collected, Taprit, Army Mule, and more. We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
Owning multiple grade stakes winning racehorses like Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership with West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So some West Point news from the sale. They bought 5 yearlings at Facic Tipton Saratoga as of yesterday, and there are small pieces of 3 of them still available. There's an Army Mule colt that's going to go to Todd Pletcher, a Bolt Doro colt that's going to Christoph Clement, and a Quality Road colt who's also going to go to Todd Pletcher, and Dripping Gold, who we talked about last week, had a very nice first out win on the Saratoga turf. Is going to be pointing to the Breeders' Cup Juvenile turf at Del Mar, probably have a prep race or two in between then. All right, so Bill's not just here to do this show. He was covering the Racing and Gaming Conference here at Saratoga yesterday. There was a lot of big news in that time. We talked to David O'Rourke about a lot of his comments earlier, which was really fascinating. But I think the thrust of it and a lot of it was about HISA and how realistic it is that HISA is going to be implemented by its scheduled date, which is July 1st, 2022. It seems like that's seeming unlikely, and there were some competing interests at the conference yesterday and people who are indeed suing to try to stop that because they say it's unconstitutional. Bill, what did you learn from yesterday?
Yeah, Joe, I mean, I don't think I've given this enough thought, but there's two reasons why HISA is, I'm not even saying might not happen, will not happen on July 1st, 2022. And that was one of the subjects that they were talking about at the gaming conference. First of all, there's the logistics and all the hurdles that the states have to jump through to get this. You can't just pull the plug on everything on June 30th and then on July 1 say, oh, HISA's here.
Yeah.
It's going to take an incredible amount of work. And you're dealing with government agencies and agencies that are used to taking their time with things. And I think it was very unreasonable for the authority or whomever is in charge to say, or even to put this date out there. It was never going to happen. But on top of that, now, you know, we've heard a lot from the, and we're all pro-HISA guys, we've heard a lot from the pro-HISA side. We haven't heard much from the anti-HISA guys, and they had their voice there. And I don't agree with a thing they have to say. And John, I'm stealing your thunder, but I'll say it. You know, you ask these guys, why do you want to get rid of it? It's unconstitutional. Or maybe Joe, you said, I'll give you both credit. Why do you want to get rid of this? It's unconstitutional. Okay, what's a better system? I don't know. That's not an okay answer. It's just not. But look, these are people that are determined to do everything they can to submarine this thing. Will they win in the long run? No, I don't think so. But I think that we've kind of just taken this threat lightly. And whether they win or not, they, at the very least, they can keep this thing tied up for years in courts. And Bennett Liebman, who is one of the moderators of this and a very astute guy, he even predicted there's a chance this will go all the way to the Supreme Court. Now, is it going to happen on July 1, 2022? No. How long is it going to take? It's just a guess. I think it might be 3 years or something like that, which is really discouraging because we all want change now. But if it's going to happen, trust me, it's not happening July 1, 2022.
Yeah, I mean, and that's unfortunate. But like you said, it's not necessarily just the lawsuits that are going to delay this thing. It's that there's so much to do for the authority. Yeah. Even in a perfect world where nobody was suing to stop this, there's so much to do. There's so much to regulate. There's so many rules to come up with. There's comment periods. It has to go to the FTC and then be posted for several months before it can become law. So, yeah, I mean, it was very ambitious when this passed to try to set it up in a year and a half. But it's depressing, and it's you know, like we've said before, this isn't like a fix-all situation. This is certainly going to need some finessing and some adjustments, even when it does, hopefully, if and when it does come into being. It's going to be a process, but just the idea that there are legal hurdles and there are logistical hurdles that are going to delay this for several years, it's very depressing. And it's unfortunate because I do feel like there's a lot of positive momentum in the right direction for racing to clean itself up.
But it just, it's a slow moving process, and it's not gonna be very satisfying, I think, in the next year or so, because we've built this up so much. We've built it up as, you know, not, like I said, not a cure all, but something that's, you know, the once in a lifetime opportunity for racing reform.
And the other thing, you know, God forbid we have another huge scandal between now and the time HISA comes in. And by the way, that very well could happen. I'm getting a little off track here, but you know, we still think that maybe someday they will indict a bunch of more people in the service Navarro because of all the records kept by the drug sellers and the vets, et cetera. So, or, you know, a prominent horse breaks down or something. There's all sorts of negative things that we hope won't happen, but could happen between now and the beginning of HISA. And Alan Foreman, who's been on the show before, you know, basically said, time is up. You know, we have to change. We've lost the narrative. We need change, and we need change now.
Right. And Bill, did they discuss at all the elephant in the room, which is how to pay for this?
You know, actually, only the anti-HISA guys. They painted the picture of, and you know, I don't know exactly how this would work, and we don't know how the funding is exactly going to work. But they, you know, and honestly, John, maybe they had a little bit of a point. They were saying that, so we assume that it's going to be some sort of start fee. Okay, so John Green starts a horse on a Saturday at Saratoga. You might have to spend $50 or something. I mean, presumably that's it. I think you'd be glad to do that.
Oh,
it's not a
heartbeat.
Lot of money, and it's for the good of racing. But they're trying to say the guy running in a five claimer at Prairie Meadows, that $50 may actually mean something to him. But, you know, so their argument was this is really going to hurt the small guys. And in some respects, I think they have an argument. I think John Green running a $100,000 stakes race at Saratoga should have to pay more than the guy running in a five-claimer at Prairie Meadows. That only makes common sense.
But
that's one of the things, getting back to the original point. They haven't worked this out.
Right.
That's
one
of 8,000 things they have to work out. And if they're making progress, it's certainly happening behind the scenes without anybody telling anybody. I mean, what have we ever heard about what kind of progress is being made? We don't hear a thing.
Yeah, I mean, and that's where the proponents of this have kind of left themselves open to criticism, because they've never addressed that core issue, is how this is going to be paid for, because it's going to be expensive. There's going to be a ton of drug testing. USADA doesn't come cheap. So that has been, I don't know, maybe a little bit of an oversight in just everybody being so gung-ho about this, and including us this.
Sure.
And we haven't really talked about that a lot either. So it's there's definitely a lot of hurdles. But just to transition from that, you know, just to show the how far we still have to go, Wayne Potts this week was suspended at Monmouth Park. Now, if you remember, Wayne Potts is a guy who was ruled off the grounds at Maryland, in Maryland, by Sal Sinatra for supposedly programmed training for Marcus Vitale, who we saw up here, unfortunately, fairly recently. And he's the leading trainer at Monmouth. And it just, you know, we love Monmouth Park, and, you know, Dennis Drazen's been on the show before, and I think he's an overall pretty smart guy. But eventually, I think Monmouth kind of has to answer for how it's been, I'm not going to say, in the past, definitely a cheater's paradise. I don't want to get sued here and say it's currently a cheater's paradise, but definitely with Service and Navarro around, I think Monmouth eventually has to answer for that so many guys who are bending the rules have been able to flourish there.
Well, quite frankly, it's an embarrassment. And I can say it from, you know, racing at Monmouth all these years, that that when you allow cheaters to come in, alleged or proven, it's going to water down the competition. It's going to make larger outfits like ours not want to race there anymore. Because why? Why are you trying to get your horse peaked to run second or third against somebody that's, you know, bending the rules or breaking the rules and getting an unfair advantage?
Yeah.
And this is nothing new. This is straight from, you know, the Thoroughbred Regulatory Rulings website. Wayne Potts has been, you know, has 87 different rules that he's been found guilty of. Now, some of them are administrative, but a lot of them the majority of them are drug related.
Yeah.
So if you know, as a racing jurisdiction, whether it's Monmouth or any other racetrack that's out there, that you have somebody that's coming in that has 80, 87, 80, what's the number, Monmouth? Is it 100? Is it 110? What's the number where you say, you know what, this is an embarrassment, we're not going to have this individual come to Monmouth and represent our brand? Because that's what's happening. They, you know, the trainers are there. If he gets the leading trainer award, they're going to go ahead and put a plaque up, and they're going to be proud that Wayne Potts is the leading trainer there. That's an embarrassment.
Right. And if you go back a couple of years, when Jorge Navarro, we talked about it last week, the infamous Juice Man video, Dennis Drazen came out kind of in support of Jorge Navarro when that happened, and not just, you know, we don't have, you know, jurisdiction to do anything about it. Basically, like, Jorge Navarro has represented Monmouth Park well, and we're going to continue to allow him to run horses there. So let me ask you this, as someone who used to run horses there, just as an outside observer, I think that if Monmouth cracked down on the cheaters, field size would go up, you would have more participation, but maybe that horse has left the barn already. What do you think?
Yeah, and I can only speak for our outfit, but, you know, I've been very outspoken of saying one of the reasons why we don't run at Monmouth is because it's an unfair situation. Yeah. I just said it 5 seconds ago, and I'll say it again. It's an unfair situation. So why run there? Why run there, you know, when you know going into it you're defeated? It just doesn't make any sense. So, yes, if they rid themselves of Navarro and Jason Service and people like Wayne Potts at this point, you know, yeah, we would consider bringing our operation back. I can't speak for other groups and other operations, but I know that in speaking to other owners and other trainers, they look at it and they say, why? Why would I go there? Now, if they raise purses, would people go there? I'm sure they would go back because at some point in time, people have a price. But it would keep us out of racing at Monmouth, that a racetrack that I love. I mean, it pains me to say that. Yeah. I live 5 miles away from the racetrack, and we raced there for 30-something straight years. So it's difficult to have these conversations. But you can't have your leading trainer be representative and have 87, now 88 different, discretions.
So there's another story here, too, I want to touch upon. New Jersey Racing Commission is incompetent and run by incompetence. And one of the reasons I say that, one of the many reasons I say that is, John, we were talking about this last night, for the last 10 years, I cannot remember a single positive of anybody at any time coming out of Monmouth. Now, they had the Juice Man and Service, and of course they never caught them, and they never caught anybody doing anything. So I do wonder how much do you need to mess up to actually
how
get
egregious
caught
does this have to be
by the New
right.
Jersey Racing Commission?
Right.
Maybe Wayne Potts just doesn't care.
Yeah, and you know, it's that stuff trickles down to the bettors too, because it makes it an unbettable product. Bettors can't trust the integrity of it. Short fields, short price favorites, and it makes it kind of an unworkable racetrack, which is unfortunate because it's a beautiful place and we all love it. Obviously, you guys are closer to it than I am, but you know, we finally got the answer. We always talk about guys getting 10th, 12th, 15th, 20th chances. The 88th chance is when they bust you. 88 is the limit, and then they'll knock on your door and say you can't race here, at least for a little bit. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
All right, so that's a wrap on our 100th show. I just got to say that it is an absolute honor and an accomplishment that I'm proud of, and I know we're all proud of, to get to 100 episodes. Listen, I don't listen to podcasts, but this one caught on somehow for some reason, and we appreciate all the support from the sponsors, obviously Bill and John and everybody who's jumped in along the way, Kelsey, Al, Brian, our incredible production staff, Patty, Nathan, who's here, Eldon Phillips, who jumped in from Naira. I want to thank Naira for letting us have this set up right here, Tony Alavato in particular. We really are appreciative of that and honored to be here because they do such a great job on a day-to-day basis. And it's just so great to be at Saratoga. I'm getting a little emotional here, but it's so full circle for us and for everybody in racing to be able to come back here, but especially for us to be able to celebrate this milestone here at Saratoga. We really can't ask for anything more. So with that, that's going to do it for the 100th episode of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Don't forget, the Keeneland September catalog is online now. 4,034 yearlings. The sale starts Monday, September 13th. You can learn more at catalog.keeneland.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, David O'Rourke, also Andy Serling and Jose Ortiz, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Ritz, and like I said, Nathan Wilkinson and Eldon Phillips. Thank you guys so much for chipping in. We hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you next week back in the studio.
Yeah. Great job, everybody. Great job.
Well done, y'all.